Hey there, everybody. Before we jump into this week's show, it's time to talk about the good folks at Lumi Labs. You know Lumi Labs. They are the masters of microdosing, and they want me to explain the benefits of microdosing using their Delta-9 THC gummies. If you're stressed out or your mind likes to run a million miles a minute, then you might want to give Lumi gummies a try. They offer indica, sativa, and hybrid gummies that are designed to be taken in smaller doses to maintain a level of calm throughout the day. Or if you just want the pleasant sensation of being a bit stoned, you can take a couple more and you're good to go. I'm not your dad. You can enjoy these gummies however you see fit. They're one of our longest sponsors, and I can personally vouch for their quality as they've helped me fight off insomnia and the dreaded vampiric sleep schedule my body likes to default to. And the best part is you can get them sent straight to your front door no matter what the marijuana laws are where you live. So check out microdose.com and see their wares. If you decide to pick something up, make sure to use the code KINGCAST at checkout to get 30% off and get free shipping. That's microdose.com, code KINGCAST. And of course, I have to tell you about our corporate overlords. Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and is delivered right to your front door 4 times a year, each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including from time to time your intrepid KINGCAST host. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, you will need to subscribe, and to do that, all you got to do is head on over to fangoria.com and sign up. If you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save a whopping, astronomical, massive, gargantuan, huge 25% off of your subscription. Now on with the show.
Hi, my name is Stephen King.
He's gonna break!
Bedlam!
Bedlam! You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes dead is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KINGCAST on the Fangoria Podcast Network. I'm your host, Eric Vespi, and today I'll be having a chat with one of my favorite working filmmakers. He's the writer and director behind flicks like Mud, Loving, Shotgun Stories, Midnight Special, and one of my all-time favorites, Take Shelter. He has a new movie out called The Bike Rider, starring Jodie Comer, Austin Butler, and Tom Hardy. And we're going to talk about that, as well as Stephen King's very first collection of short stories, Night Shift. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Jeff Nichols to the KINGCAST stage.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, thanks for coming on. Like, I'm not kidding when I say that, like, Take Shelter is one of my all-time favorites. I remember seeing that. It was Sundance that premiered, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember seeing that at Sundance, and I came back home just, like, buzzing about it, and there was nobody that I could talk to about it. Because I, you know, outside of the core group that I'd seen it with at Sundance, you know, all my L.A. friends, and like, you know, when you see that movie, you just really want to, like, pick it apart and talk about it. It's like, oh, at what point is this? You know, what point is, do we know X, Y, and Z? And I'm now realizing I'm starting to dance around spoilers like it's a fresh movie. It's been out there. I probably shouldn't. But just in case you haven't seen it, go see it. You'll love it. But the story that I want to tell you to kick things off here is right after I got back, this is my Ain't It Cool days, and I got a sit down with Jessica Chastain for Tree of Life. And I kind of offhandedly mentioned that I'd just seen Take Shelter and how much I loved it. And she, like, her eyes lit up and she leaned in and she was like, oh my God, I can't talk about that movie with anybody because I haven't seen it. Let's talk about it. And, like, it totally derailed our chat. And we had to have, like, a very spoilery off the record part of that interview that I had to cut out.
That's
all she wanted to do was talk about the movie. Do you still have people coming up to you or at events or anything and talking about that?
I mean, definitely. You can tell a lot by a person. If they know my films at all,
yeah,
then it's you're either a Mud person or you're a Take Shelter person.
Ooh.
And yeah, it says a lot about you, Eric.
Is it bad? It sounds like it's bad.
No. It's kind of been fascinating, I don't know, to encounter people's continued reactions to that film, you know. It's just so interesting as the film projects get bigger, they get more expensive. Mm. You feel, I don't know about pressure, but you definitely feel a little bit more aware in terms of how they may or may not go out into the world, you know. and Take Shelter, we didn't have that pressure at all. You know, we did, I think, 3, you know, screen tests for the bike riders. And, you know, there are a lot of opinions and a lot of thoughts kind of flying around because you're making this big, expensive movie and you want it to do X, Y, and Z. I had never screened Take Shelter for really anyone until we were sitting in the Eccles Theater, which is the biggest theater at Sundance. You know, I think I'd showed it maybe to like 5 or 6 friends, was like the biggest kind of group I had shown it to. And I'm sitting next to Michael Shannon, who had not seen it in this theater. And the lights go down and I realize, wow, like this is, I have no idea how the world or people in this theater are going to respond to this. And we get to the part of the film where Mike flips over that table.
Right.
And there's this ripple of laughter. And I just remember dropping my head and thinking, well, 2 movies, like that's good enough.
You had a good shot.
Like that was a good run. A lot of people don't get to make any movies. And and then it ended and, you know, people applauded or whatever. And, you know, people are giving you compliments, but in your heart, you're like, no, it didn't work. Like, I know it didn't work. And then, you know, the reviews come out the next day and they're kind of insanely good. And I was like, what's going on here? Because then people were kind of really talking about it. So I snuck into another screening at a smaller theater for that same spot. And I heard the same kind of ripple of laughter. And I was like, oh man, they're not laughing. They feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that's when I was like, I'm going to have a great career. this is totally going to work. I'm a genius. I'm not, but that film was really personal to me. It was right when I was getting married and starting to think about having a family. I mean, when I shot that film, my wife was 8 months pregnant. I came home. We shot that outside of Cleveland. I came home and 2 weeks later, my son was born. I edited that film in his nursery. My wife was like, you can't leave for the first 3 months. Right. And so I set up my editing room with headphones. Thank God I didn't want to scar the child. And I cut that film right next to his crib, you know? And so the feeling of anxiety in the world and the economy was collapsing in 2008 when I wrote that, you know, it was palpable in my life and it's imprinted in the DNA of that film, you know? And so this might sound arrogant, but it makes sense that people connected to it because it was so palpable for me.
You know? Right.
I still think back on that time and like my stomach kind of churns a little bit.
Yeah. And it's crazy is that, Michael Shannon's character in that wouldn't be seen as extreme today. You know what I mean? I don't know. It's that doesn't bode very well for us as a society that, that today kind of looking at that and it feels like quaint, you know, seeing a guy, you know, slowly become obsessed with his, I mean, at least he's only doing his own shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
I love that movie. And I think part of the reason why I love it is that I'm a big fan of, you know, 70s cinema for a lot of reasons, but mainly because it's like the best decade for seeing character actors get to lead movies.
Right.
You know what I mean? You get, you know, Walter Matthau gets to be the star of a shit ton of movies in that, you know, in that decade. Richard Dreyfuss, you know, that kind of stuff where it's like the movie stars got to be the weirdos. And I think that, you know, that kind of ties in a little bit to why I responded so well to Bike Riders when I saw it this past Monday is I'm watching this and like you can't deny that, you know, one, Jodie Comer really carries the movie in a way that I was not expecting from any of the marketing materials.
Correct.
So I was immediately knocked out by that, but you know, she's doing it in a way where she's like lost in a character. Tom Hardy is doing his thing, but he is like absolutely putting in a great character actor performance in this thing.
Is.
And then Butler is just radiating like this is a movie star guy, but he's doing it in a weird, greasy, grimy character actory way. So I think that, you know, that I like just instantly responded to this movie because you're giving essentially these movie stars the ability to be character actors again. You know what I mean? And
amongst other character actors. I mean, you know, well,
act, yeah.
Character actor, you know, sometimes it sounds like a pejorative, but it's not. Those are just the actors I want to work with. But it's the whole point of the movie, and because it's kind of a strange movie, and I don't want to undo all of the brilliant marketing that they've been doing. But, you know, the book that inspired it is just about people sitting around talking about kind of random things in their life and, you know, motorcycles and the way they feel. And the movie's kind of like that. It really is. There are fights and there's bars getting burned down and you know, motorcycles. But it's really people sitting around talking about why they live the way they do and why they think the way they do and other just kind of random stories. And so you had to have actors that could fit in that population.
Right.
You know, like it doesn't make sense to have Michael Shannon just killing it with these two monologues and then you cut and you don't believe the guy you're cutting to, you know, or cutting away from. They all had to kind of live in this world. And I think the thing, you know, I love about each of those actors is, you know, Tom Hardy, we never know what that guy's going to do.
Right.
Genuinely, every performance just has such a unique quality to it. Jodie Comer is a complete chameleon.
Yeah.
And I find it interesting that we live in a time that's so balkanized in terms of, you know, you have either seen Killing Eve or you haven't, which means you either love Jodie Comer or you're not sure who she is. And that's all going to change, you know, but if you are one of the special few that know, like she's just incredible. I mean, she's just incredible. And then you have Austin who is coming into his own. He's famous for a role that even though he didn't have a mask on, he definitely felt like he was behind Elvis, you know, like Elvis was in front, which is a huge compliment to Austin. That's
right.
But now you've kind of taken that mask away because he looks like Austin in the movie.
Yeah.
And so we're getting to see him kind of find the character of himself in this film, you know, the closest in terms of just the physicality of him, if nothing else. So anyway, it was a real kind of special thing to be able to seat these movie stars, which is what they are, amongst all of these incredible actors and friends that I have.
Well, and by doing so and by framing it the way that you do, it just strikes me as a movie. I think that's what they ask us to fill out these comment cards at the end of these screenings. And
yeah, I tell them not to send those to me, by the way.
It's like, yeah, I don't want to know. Well, the screening I was at was like a little bit of press and everybody else was like the local Harley Davidson stuff. But you know, when you're going for that audience, it was funny because it was like mostly like aged bikers, right? In the crowd. And a lot of them hadn't seen a movie in like years. I think one of them I was talking to in the concession saying, he's like, I haven't seen a movie since 2016 or something. he came out to this one. And they fucking loved it. Like they were hooting and hollering over, you know, over a lot of the jargon that I didn't understand about like motorcycles and whatnot. So you got that stuff right. But what I really loved about the feeling of it is that it's just a movie. And that's, again, that comment card. That's the only thing I could say. It's like, this is a movie. I mean, it's not an IP. It's not a franchise. It's just letting these incredibly charismatic people carry you into a different time period. You know what I mean? And like it was just so refreshing. I didn't realize, like, it was like having a drink of water after being in the desert. And like, listen, I love IP stuff. I love superhero movies. I love horror sequels. I love, you know, all that stuff is my bread and butter. I love it to death. But I didn't realize like just how much I was missing seeing a movie like this in theaters.
Well, thanks.
So I guess the question is like, how the hell do you get a movie like this made today when, you know, just screens are taken up by, you know, everything else, you know, if it's not an animated movie or something. Like, I know I sound like the old man shaking his fist at the cloud, right?
that's state of being is just shaking my fist at things.
And
I'm only 45, so I feel, you know, I'm ahead of my time.
Yeah.
Well, before I answer your question specifically, you know, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and it was always amazing to be able to drop back into a film, whether it's on TV and now it's on streaming.
Yeah.
You know, all these films, and they're random, but it's like, you know, obviously you can drop into Goodfellas at any time, like a streaming algorithm gives me Goodfellas, like it knows, I'm going to watch the first hour of that film, and not shut it off. But also, I mean, all those 80s and 90s films, like random stuff like Pelican Brief, mm-hmm. or like, The Hunt for Red October.
Yep,
like,
The Firm.
Like, yeah, exactly. Like, not just John Grisham novels, but sure. You yeah. know, like it's like these films.
Rainmaker. I can keep going, buddy.
Oh, so. Yeah, buddy. Exactly. But like, you know, these films that you would just drop into the middle of with commercial breaks and you just wouldn't turn them off. You would just sit right. there and watch them. When you say movie, that's what I think about is yeah. – And my hope is that one day, you know, The Bike Riders is one of those films that lives on whatever these services are. Right. And whenever it shows up, there's going to be a contingent of people that just want to click and watch the first hour of that movie without, you know, without shutting it down. That's it, and it kind of leads in, I guess, to the answer to your question, your real question, you know, how do you get something like this done? I certainly don't calculate at the writing stage. These things just have to feel cool. It's kind right. of a gut feeling, you know. It's the same instinct as writing Take Shelter or even Mud. You're just like, I just feel like this is something I want to watch. It feels like something that I could have watched back in the 80s and 90s. It feels like something, you know, that it already exists before I've written it, you know. Right. And I don't say that to be kind of artsy or weird or dreamy. But that's the closest I get to like a market calculation is, right. you know, it just feels like I could see it walking around out in the world. And The Bike Riders always felt like that to me, you know, from the day that I picked up the book, it was like, yeah, this feels, dense enough to carry, you know, the weight of making a movie. 'Cause I mean, it's a gauntlet of a process. Take the financing aside for a second, which is really kind of at the heart of your question. But yeah. if you put that aside for a second, it's just, you know, you got to carry it through pre-production and all those things and then production and post. And now you're screening the film and testing it and doing all this junk. And then it's got to go out into the world and yeah. live and connect to some people and not others. And so you need an idea that just feels like it can survive, you right. know, that challenging process. And from the minute I looked at Danny Lyon's book, because it's not just photographs, it's also these interviews that he did, and you feel like you really get to know these people. You feel like it shows the full breadth of a subculture, which as a storyteller, you're really looking to do that with an audience. At least I am, where you know, like in a film like Mud, you really wanted people to feel like they had lived down in that river for, right. for 2 hours, you know, and got kind of muddy. And mm-hmm. in this movie, you got to get kind of greasy. And the thing that Danny did was he gave me all those details because I didn't grow up in this world. I didn't grow up around bikes or biker right. culture. But Danny's book has it all the important stuff, you know, like kind of what makes people tick and all the necessary details to kind of bring it back to life. So again, back to your actual question, you feel like you have a thing of value, and then it becomes, and I don't know if I'm just kind of fooling myself, but you walk into a room and when people say they don't want to make it, you just look at them kind of confused. Like,
right.
But don't you feel all the things I've been feeling? And I do that with most all of my projects because I genuinely feel that way. You know, the good news for The Bike Riders is we didn't have to do very much. And I know everybody likes to talk about how hard it is to make movies. And so everybody listening can just be like, this guy is an asshole. Like, but my producing partner, Brian Kavanaugh Jones, who I've, you know, been working with pretty much since he helped me find the finishing funds for Shotgun Stories. So I've been with him pretty much my whole career. He you know, was friends and was doing some other business with New Regency, which is a really unique company slash kind of mini studio. Mm-hmm. You know, New Regency was started by Arnon Milchan back, I think, in the 70s. You know, they did King of Comedy, Brazil, then, you know, I've gone on to do Pretty Woman, Fight Club, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, you know, The Lighthouse. Like, they just continued to make films over decades that make sense and are successful. But when you really look at them from the front end, seem pretty, I don't know, like special choices, challenging choices. And I think when Brian called me, was like, I'm going to slip it to New Regency. Like, we're not going to have a bidding war. We're not going to go out. Let me just slip it to this guy. He's a real straight shooter and he'll just tell us what he thinks. And they kind of immediately came back and were like, yeah, we want to make this. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was really just one meeting and they said yes. And what makes New Regency interesting is they also then finance the marketing and distribution. They're kind of a one-stop shop, but for when they pair with another studio, like they did in this case, they ended up pairing with Focus, which is what they had done on Robert Eggers' film, The Northmen, and had a really great relationship with them.
Right.
And that's a different thing we can talk about. the challenge wasn't really getting the film made. It was actually just getting it out into the world, which is where we're at today. But they really saw it. We also came in at a good price point. This is a podcast to talk about nerdy stuff. I mean, this is pretty nerdy. Right. You know, you hold a price that you want to make your movie at, and then there's another price, which is the price that the world is willing to give you for it. And they're usually separated by millions of dollars. And I remember it with Loving. You know, we really wanted about $15 million to make that movie. And we went out at that price with the script. And I just knew in my heart, I was like, $10 million. That's what we can get. You know, with Joel and Ruth, like, it's $10 million. And that's about exactly what we hit, you know, to get to go make that film. Take Shelter, I wanted $2 million. And that turned out to be about $650,000. You know?
Jesus, man.
And that's what the world wanted to give for that film and for you and the actor. You know, it's right. This kind of recipe that they look at. And this film, you know, we were at a reasonable price point without actors yet. I mean, that's the crazy thing is New Regency said yes without any cast attached. Mm. So I have to say, and this is the longest, I'm glad this is a long podcast. The script was cool, man. Like the script was, it's what you see on the screen. And I put a lot of effort into it, but you sat down and read it and it felt like a movie, you know?
Right. Well, and I have to imagine, like, when you get the cast that you got, it has to work on the page. You know, nothing makes an actor more excited than you know, reading a nice juicy character on a page and have it jumping out to him. So, I mean, listen, I could focus on this all day. My time with you is limited.
You have to talk about Stephen King. Oh, right.
You got to talk about Stephen King or else the listeners are going to revolt. They're going to go,
like, you know, what the hell is this?
Womp our pieces out. And then suddenly this is just a straight interview show. What the hell happened to my beloved King cast?
Oh.
We'll circle back to this at the end of the chat, you know, cause I'm not done talking bike riders with you yet, but in the meantime, I'd love to get your Stephen King origin story.
I have to give a few caveats. Which is, I'm not a prolific King reader, but if you're in the culture in the 80s and 90s, and you know, you're going to know about him, obviously. My first experience was in fourth grade. My best friend in fourth grade was a guy named Brad Carter, who I've lost all contact with, but I believe he's actually writing horror, and he might teach at the University of Arkansas. I'm not sure. Mm. But Brad was a really smart kid. He was definitely my bad influence friend. Mm. He's the first kid that gave me a cigarette, which I hate to this day. But he read It in fourth grade, you know? And I remember looking at I could barely read a comic book. And this kid read It. And I remember thinking that was so intelligent that he could get through a book of that size. And he would tell me about it. and it terrified me. And my first interactions with horror, because my house was pretty vanilla. It was all through Brad Carter, and he was obsessed with Stephen King. Mm-hmm. And here's kind of, I guess, the important point I want to make. It was always associated with intelligence. Like, I considered Brad to be smart. Yes, he liked horror, and he loved Metallica, and he loved heavy metal. You know, like, he liked these pop culture things, but it felt like this was a well-read, intelligent person. I never associated King with, you know, like, poppy kind of dime store novels. I just always consider him, you know, literary.
Right. King at the height of his popularity, he like was self denigrating, and he was calling himself an airport novelist and stuff. And
yeah,
you know, and it, yeah, which obviously time has shown to be untrue, but yeah, I get what you're saying.
Yeah, for sure. You know, like, and my dad was a prolific reader. I just was a late bloomer. I just wasn't very good at it. I read comic books like nonstop. And that's really how I learned to read, to be honest. And it wasn't until college that I really, kind of a window in my mind opened up, and I started to read a lot more literature and a lot more books, you know. But I remember my dad grew up on John D. McDonald, books. And I think I read somewhere that King thought John D. McDonald was, you know, one of his favorite authors. And so, you know, and my dad's also reading Louis L'Amour. So I think I'm looking at the people that I consider intelligent, the people I consider well-read in my life, and they're reading King, and they're reading Louis L'Amour and John D. McDonald. And so I'm associating that type of writing with good thinking people, you know,
right.
smart people. So it's a strange answer to your question, because it's not like, you know, I can give you that answer, which is I saw the TV movie of It, and I couldn't leave my house for a month.
Right.
You know, right. When he opens that refrigerator and that guy's decapitated head is in there. It's just, like, yeah. I can't.
Richard Mazur's in there just singing songs and taunting like everybody. Yeah.
I was truly disturbing for me. You know, I can also tell you that The Shining was a formative film for me. But again, I come at them through the films and not the books. So
which is totally fine. We've had people on the show that have never picked up a Stephen King book in their life. We like to make fun of Elijah Wood for coming on and talking because he loves Rob Reiner's Misery. So he, you know, and
so good.
It's become a bit of a running joke on the show that the Elijah can't read. You know, but no, I mean, that's my entrance in the King is through the movies. I was a movie kid. I wasn't a book reader. Like, I was kind of like you. I read comic books. I'd read those, what were they called? The like scary stories to tell in the dark that you would get at the book fairs, you know, or the little short stories, which kind of ties into what the topic is today. But it was movies. And my first King book was Cujo, which I read in the sixth grade. And I read that because I just got it in my head. My mom was a big King reader, so these paperbacks and some hardcovers, but mostly paperbacks, were all over the house. And I saw the cover for Cujo, and I'd seen the movie. So I was just like, hey, if I've seen the movie, I can read the book and understand what's going on, you know? And, I maybe wasn't quite prepared for all the adultery and marriage strife stuff in the book. And
how great is that as a kid, though? You know, like that you're getting... It's like you're getting to peek into an adult world, and they're letting you because it's a book, and they're like, well, as long as he's reading something, you know, like
that is a great loophole in growing up in any kind of conservative society is that for most part, I guess that there's a lot of conservatives that don't like books now, but you know, but back then, you know, in the 80s and 90s, it was just like I could be reading Caligula, you know, and they wouldn't give a shit. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Like, well, he's going to be smart. I mean, you know, to talk about The Shining, and I won't spend too much time on this because I've told this anecdote before, but you know, I'm watching The Shining, and it's a direct influence on Take Shelter, on the style of direction, because you know. I was watching it when I was prepping that film. So I actually hadn't seen The Shining until I was out of film school. So I'm thinking about filmmaking and I'm thinking about directing. Whenever you're in prep for a movie, you watch movies differently because you're like, oh shit, I got to pay attention now and like get ready. And I'm watching The Shining just on television. And I see this slow push in behind Jack Nicholson's character as he's at the typewriter. And I was like, wait a second. You know, Kubrick doesn't do unmotivated camera movement. Like, he has a reason for moving the camera. But why is he doing this? Yes, it feels creepy, but why does it feel creepy? Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, because every shot has a point of view. And that's the point of view of the hotel, of the spirit. And I just completely stole that. And if you look at Take Shelter, every shot almost has this slow kind of creeping push in on it. And it's not motivated by any character within the frame of the film. It's just that feeling of anxiety that is ever present, you know, in that film and kind of closing in on Michael Shannon. So that's a direct inspiration from, you know, from The Shining, which I'm sure you've talked. There've been many debates about that on this podcast, but yeah. So, you know, there are plenty of very specific references I can give you, but Brad Carter and him toting around this massive copy of It, that really, my bad influence friend in fourth grade, he's the one.
Yeah, great. No, it's wonderful. I'd also like, you know, I love the mention of The Shining parallels in Take Shelter. You know, and it's also worth noting that, like, Midnight Special is like a better Firestarter remake than the Firestarter remake ended up being. You know what I mean? It's like it feels like that you have a natural inclination to get into this Stephen King mindset where it's character first, really cool, you know, world around it, and then some, you know, something nuts is going to happen. Even in the Bike Riders, there's not any supernatural elements or any, well, I was going to say any horror elements. There's some horrific stuff that happens in the movie, but it's not, you know, it's not Stephen King horror elements. It's real life horror elements. I don't know. It feels like you're drawn to the same stuff.
Well, he's a good writer.
I love your work so much because that's my favorite.
I appreciate that. I mean, but because I've read interviews with King, and I mean, he's just constantly thinking about good storytelling.
Yeah.
That seems to be his stock of trade. And if you're going to think about good storytelling, you just don't sit around thinking about plot. Like it's not your main concern because you have to just think about character, not just, but you have to think about character at least in the same value as plot. And you can just tell that's what he does.
Welcome to the mid-roll ad read, everybody. I just have one sponsor to tell you about before we jump back into this chat with Jeff Nichols. And it's a really cool one. I am a huge fan of Ty West's films. In particular, I've loved what he's done with these X films starring Mia Goth. And guess what? They want me to tell you all about the brand new one called Maxine. Now, they sent a little ad read to do, and I want to try out my Percy Rodriguez kind of trailer guy voice. If you're not familiar, Percy Rodriguez was the guy that did like all the best trailers from like the 70s and 80s. He had a very deep, gravelly voice. I can only do about 20% as great as him, but I'm going to give it a shot with this. Are you guys ready? Let's do it.
On July 5th, A24 presents Ty West's Maxine, the explosive finale of Ty West's X trilogy. Maxine Minx is back for her stab at stardom, starring Mia Goth, Elizabeth Debicki, Moses Sumney, Halsey, Lily Collins, and Kevin Bacon. See Maxine in theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.
Not too bad. I could probably need to smoke a few more packs of cigarettes next time, but I think I'm getting there. Not joking around. I love Ty West stuff, man. I've going back to House of the Devil and The Innkeepers, The Sacrament. That dude just speaks my language. So I'm psyched to see Maxine. I will be seeing it sooner than later. And I encourage you all to do the same. Now let's jump back into this chat with Mr. Jeff Nichols, shall we?
Yeah.
So your chosen title today is Night Shift, which when that kind of came through, I was surprised and happily surprised because, you know, that's sometimes like for these short story collections, you know, that to me, that's kind of a sign of like, oh, this person like actually has something to say about, you know, about this title other than, well, I rewatched Shawshank the other day. So let's talk about that. Yes. You know what I mean? So why Night Shift out of everything when you were confronted with the, what title do you want to talk
with
about
this question?
Stephen King.
Well, one, cause I'd read it. but
check.
The truth is the things that I have read of King's have been his novellas and his short fiction.
Right.
The Body is incredible.
Yeah.
Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption is incredible. You know, those things I sought out and purposefully read. Short fiction has always been what I'm drawn to. And I think in part because it translates to movies better. You know, the truth is novels are a completely different art form in terms of the style of storytelling and the length and just what you do in a novel. A novella and a short story, now those make good movies. And so, you know, in college, I discovered Larry Brown and I was reading his collections of short stories, Big Bad Love, Facing the Music. I got real big into Raymond Carver. And so whenever I would see a short story collection, you know, I would pick it up. And of course, when I first encountered The Body, I knew about Stand By Me. And it's just great writing. But it's interesting to me that I was most attracted to, you know, the novella and the short story that by King, that they're not, I guess, horror based.
Right.
It's him just describing things that seem very personal to him, especially in The Body. And so anyway, I pick up Night Shift, post college, post my first film, actually Shotgun Stories. And I do it just because I'm wanting to read short fiction. Maybe it's right for my attention span, but it definitely is better for my job. And this thing, the one story that just really stuck out to me was Night Surf. Mm. I found it haunting. And again, it's an odd one for King because it's pretty, I guess, sci-fi, you know, post-apocalyptic. So it makes sense that in 2000, probably six, I'm picking this book up, which is 2 years before I would sit down and write Take Shelter. But I have to tell an anecdote that isn't totally related, but I had done Shotgun Stories and I was broke. You know, my family and friends helped finance that film, and every dollar I made from 2004 to 2006 went into making that film. And the finishing funds company that had helped us complete that film was making really cheap horror films in Louisiana. And they called and were like, hey, we'll pay you $5,000 to write a script for a sequel to this really bad horror film they had already made. Mm. And they had something going on where, I don't know, with tax incentives and everything else, they figured out how to make money on all these movies. And I was getting married and I needed $5,000 to pay for the wedding. And so I said, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write you a script, but I'm not going to put my name on it. You can put your name on it. I don't care. I'm going to write it in a week. I wrote it in 5 days.
Hmm.
And I've never done this before where I was like, whatever I write, I'm not going to go back and reread. Hmm. I'm just going to write it from beginning to end. And I wrote, I think, probably one of the coolest opening scenes in any movie I'll ever write.
Uh-huh.
In this film that will never exist and technically doesn't exist. But it was inspired by the beginning of Night Surf, being next to a fire and then realizing what's burning.
Mm-hmm.
And it was directly inspired by Night Surf. And I had this young gutter punk couple making love by a bonfire. And then when they finished, the woman climaxes. That's the other thing. Like, it totally felt like it was my opportunity because I wasn't writing it under my name. I could have I could have sex and I could have just crazy violence and all this stuff.
This so is your Richard Bachman script as well.
Yeah. I mean, so it opens with, you know, this woman's breasts, like, you know, like, and all this sex anyway. And she climaxes and they climax and they finish. And the guy goes to smoke a cigarette and he's going to light it in the bonfire. And it's a car that's on fire. And there's a hand sticking out the window, handcuffed to the side mirror, and he lights this cigarette off of it. It was the coolest scene, and it was directly ripped off from Night Surf. So, you know, when I got this call about this podcast, that's why I bring up a Night Shift. I can't even sadly speak, you know, in detail about the whole book.
Oh, that's fine.
But Night Surf definitely it stuck out to me, and it could not help but kind of I don't know, infiltrate the water that I was drinking in those days. And
right.
and it definitely then had an impact on the idea about apocalyptic visions that would become Take Shelter. Like, all that stuff is kind of in a 2-year run for me.
Insane. Yeah, no, I never would have connected the dots there, but I think that that makes all the sense in the world looking at it now. Night Surf is also really interesting to me in this collection because there's a Captain Trips reference. It's, you, as you mentioned, the world's kind of coming to an end, and this, you kind of realize reading this that this is a parallel story that's happening alongside The Stand, right?
Mm-hmm.
And King doesn't revisit his stuff very often. You know, there are a few examples, Dr. Sleep, you know, Talisman and Black House.
Yeah.
You know, he's done a few sequels in his life, the Dark Tower series and whatnot. But for whatever reason, in this period of time, and this is his first short story collection, it's published in 78, I believe. It's like 80% or more, like, just him collecting all these stories he had written for Titty Mags.
Right.
So they're exploitative, as you mentioned. You know, there's lots of sex, there's lots of booze, there's lots of it, the I've noticed that the Gentleman's Magazine King stories, they're like jokes, right? They're set up in punchline, you know, that,
right,
for the short, right, fiction. And Night Surf doesn't really read that way, and it's one of the earlier stories. I believe it was originally published in 69.
Yeah.
And you know, and it doesn't feel like that it's a setup and a punchline. Like you said, it's just people kind of, you know, having their own endless summer. They're just sitting on the beach and realizing that somebody's, you know, somebody in their group, you know, might be sick with this.
It's,
you know,
super moody. Like, yeah, it's very much, yeah. I mean, it feels like something, a movie I'd want to make. Yeah. I mean, it's a vibe. Yeah. As much as anything, and you know, you're probably watching a guy, given the date that it was written, and this is just me kind of, I don't know the truth, but those are the seed kernels for everything that's going to come in terms of his post-apocalyptic writing, I would,
right,
think. You know, that's him kind of trying the clothes on and saying, all right, how's this feel?
Yeah, it's also interesting reading King, the kind of the radical student King that exists in a lot of this early work. The Long Walk is another example, you know, that was one of the first things he wrote in college. So, you know, he's going to college in an era where, you know, it's the Vietnam War protests, you know, it's a damn the man, you know, system. But he's also still kind of a blue collar, you know, good old boy Maine guy, you know. And that combo of being really hyper intelligent, quasi, you know, radically progressive, and just being a, you know, a small town dude through and through is kind of the magic sauce of King.
Yeah.
And a lot of that's prevalent in this short story collection. I want to run through the list of titles real quick for people who might need a reminder. But this one is Jerusalem's Lot, which is the prequel to Salem's Lot, Graveyard Shift, which is the Killer Rat story, Night Surf, I Am the Doorway, which is another crazy sci-fi story. That's the one where like eyeballs start popping up on right, the astronauts after you know, after right, they go into space and they suddenly start turning into other things. The Mangler, the Boogeyman, Gray Matter, Battleground, Trucks, which became Maximum Overdrive.
Wow.
sometimes they come back, which, you know, I'm just saying, if The Bike Riders is a huge success, maybe you do the horror sequel.
Yeah.
And you line up. Take inspiration from that one. That's all about undead greasers coming back and bullying people. Strawberry Spring, The Ledge, The Lawnmower Man, again, has zero to do with the movie that that was made, so much so that King sued that movie to have his name taken off of it. Quitters Inc., I Know What You Need, Children of the Corn, The Last Rung on the Ladder, The Man Who Loved Flowers, One for the Road, and The Woman in the Room. What strikes me going through that is, one, you're getting a lot of sequels and prequels to stuff. There's a sequel and a prequel to Salem's Lot. You have The Stand, count, you know, side story. And you're also getting a lot of melancholy stuff, like Night Surf fits that bill. The Woman in the Room is the other one where it's a guy essentially, you know, deciding whether or not he's going to, you know, help, you know, euthanizes his mother who is slowly and painfully dying, and all she wants is a way out. Again, you know, there's one thing I love about King short fiction, and this is something that, you know, probably was attractive to you too, is that, you know, he gets to try on a whole bunch of different flavors of stuff. We have Mike Flanagan has a movie coming out, maybe at the end of this year. I don't know. It's premiering at TIFF, but it's called Life of Chuck. And that's a story that's told, one, it's metaphysical, and it's also told in reverse. So it starts with the end of the world, essentially, and then it goes from there. It goes backwards in time as you're following this main character, this mysterious Chuck, and you know who he is, why he's around, and what happens, you know, what happened to him in his childhood. And you like, it's something that he doesn't, I don't think that he feels restrained that he couldn't experiment in novel form, but short story form is where he seems to kind of kick off the shoes and say, let's get going here. Sure. Is that something that you've picked up from your reading of his work?
Yeah, I think so, you know, because there's just not the commitment. You know, you can take a few more risks because you're not committing the detail and the structure and the outlining necessary to pull off a book of 1,000 pages. You know, you're like, all right, I got 30 pages. Let's see what we can do. And so it makes sense then that the pressure on your storytelling is shifted. You know, you can have a thing like Night Surf that just, it feels more like a mood or more atmospheric. You know, I don't think you could bear the weight of that over the, you know, the size of a novel. So it allows you to kind of, I just paint in different colors maybe.
Right. Now, I did also notice that a whole chunk of these have been adapted in some form. There's probably more stuff in here that's been adapted than hasn't.
Right.
Like, looking at this list. Why do you think that it makes that short stories and novellas make for better adaptations? And this is something King said when he came on the show. Like I asked him like a similar question, like, what's the secret to adapting your work? And he said, I don't know, but it sure seems like the batting average for the short stories and the novellas are higher than the novels. Right. So he's like, maybe that's the secret. Why do you think that they're more prone to be adapted into good film and TV? Is it because it's easier to expand than it is to shrink, or is there some other secret sauce in there?
Well, the truth is, even a novella doesn't need any expansion. You know, the easy answer is length, but it's more detailed than that. The truth is, when he's conceiving of that story as a piece of short fiction, then he's structurally thinking about it to fit into that format and that timing. The hardest part of storytelling is really structuring it in such a way that the audience wants to know what happens next, and that you continue narrative drive. It really is, I think, the core of good storytelling. And it can happen across any genre. But you want to know where you're at, and you want to know what happens next. And I think when an author is conceiving of a story, and if they're conceiving of it in a shorter, you know, format, then those mechanics are baked in. They're there. They are structural. They're integral. And when you start to mess with story mechanics, shit gets fucked up.
Right.
You know, like, it is not lost on me that Hollywood approaches movies as you know, and scenes in films as plug and play. You know, it's why they test movies. It's why they reshoot things. And it is not how storytelling goes. That's not how it works. Now, sure, you're going to find plenty of examples of like, but this movie got better than this movie, you know, fine. But the truth is, really good storytelling is authored by someone who understands the beginning and middle and end of their story. And so if King, as smart as we know he is thinking in a shorter format, then that structure is going to be in place. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to dismantle it. You don't have to mess with it. And because of that, you're going to have a better story. It's going to be well told because you're not messing with the fundamental mechanics of it.
Right.
Sorry, it's kind of a nerdy answer, but it's true. And if you look at the beginning and middle and end, probably of Rita Hayworth and The Body, they didn't have to fundamentally shift things. Somebody is going to go put those two things up and then correct me in the comment section. But I stand by that statement.
No. Well, and I will reiterate that this is a very cool show, not a nerdy show. So I'm going to need you to cut that shit out.
okay.
No, that's
congratulations.
I asked the question. That's exactly, you know, the kind of insight I was hoping to get from somebody who's, you know, real good at writing their own stories. So we are bumping up against the time where I got to let you go. I could talk Stephen King shit with you all day. I could talk just movie shit with you all day. But, you know, you got a movie to sell. I get it. So now's your chance to do one more plug.
I mean, it comes out June 21st. It's called The Bike Riders. If we like the idea of going to see movies that are entertaining, movies that you don't necessarily know what's going to happen, you haven't necessarily seen it before, that's this film. It's meant to be a fun time. And if you go see it in the theater, I think you'll absorb it in the way that I meant for it to be absorbed, between the sound and the size of the picture. We shot it in scope. We shot it on film. This thing is really attempting to do what Danny Lyon's book did, mm-hmm. which was kind of dip you into this subculture in the 1960s. And my hope is by the time you walk out of the theater, you feel like you visited the 1960s and you visited this very specific subculture, and you're left with the sense that it can't exist again. You know, to me, this film is very nostalgic, and that's what nostalgia is. It's our recognition that there's a moment in time and an experience in our lives that is not coming back around. Mm. And that's what The Bike Riders does.
Well, I can vouch for every word you just said. It's a wonderful flick. Go see it. Jeff, thanks so much for coming on, and maybe somewhere down the line we can have you come on and pick another great short story to talk about. Maybe.
Right, I'll go read some now, but thank you, Eric. I appreciate
it. You got homework. Many thanks to Jeff Nichols. Everybody go see The Bike Riders. It rules. I hope you guys enjoyed the chat. I know that it's a little different. The absence of Scott was felt very deeply by me on this one. And moving forward, when we run out of the Scott episodes, we are going to be having a rotating guest co-host to join me on these chats. But for this one, just the way the timing was working out, the timing of the movie coming out, it was either an hour or never. So I kind of had to make the decision. If I wanted to chat with Jeff Nichols, then I would have to do it solo. So I made the call because I'm a big Jeff Nichols fan, and he was great. I really appreciate especially towards the end there when he was talking about why these short stories and novellas are just structurally more compatible with regular cinematic storytelling. Really interesting stuff. Dig that guy, dig his movies, his new one rules, and everybody go watch it if you haven't seen it already. So coming up, well, next week's going to be a bittersweet one because it is the final KingCast episode with Scott Wampler as co-host. It's kind of fitting that it's a more rowdy episode, as Scott and I welcome the very funny comedian Brent Terhune back to the show. You'll remember him as the dude on social media that kind of takes the piss out of the more MAGA folks among us by pretty much just saying the shit they say anyway. You know, he'll go on rants in the front of his truck with his sunglasses kind of on the back of his head, that kind of stuff. Really funny guy. He joined us once before to talk about The Mist, and now he's back to discuss the great Jordy Verrill from Creepshow. That's right, we're talking the Stephen King starring segment from George Romero's Creepshow, Meteor Shit. You know the one. We called this chat an ode to Jordy Verrill, and you'll get that next week here in the main feed. And this Friday on our Patreon, I've invited our good friend Ryan Scott from SlashFilmAndFangoria.com back on the show. He's joined us a few times before, and we always kind of tap him to go over the Stephen King news that is out there. We've missed a lot of Stephen King news in these past 3 weeks with our minds being otherwise occupied with Scott Wampler business. So there's a bunch of stuff to go over, and I figured that now is a good time to kind of address that. There's stuff from Life of Chuck, The Monkey, Welcome to Derry, The Institute, The Long Walk, and probably a bunch of stuff I'm forgetting as well. But we'll break those down, get the lay of the Stephen King landscape with Ryan Scott on our Patreon. And if you want to sign up, please do. That is patreon.com/thekingcast. That will get you access to almost 4 years of episodes. We're talking commentaries and interviews and niche topics and random wild curveballs and some ridiculous stuff. Shelbyville, our RPG, is up there. Tons and tons and tons of stuff. So if you were ever on the fence, now's a good time to jump in. Once again, patreon.com/thekingcast. And yeah, hopefully we'll see some of you folks over there. All right, so we'll see you next week for the Ode to Jordy Verrill, the final pop episode of the KingCast. And then on the Patreon this Friday, we are talking about all the Stephen King news from the last few weeks. Adios, folks. The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abby Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director. And editing is done by yours truly.